I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is about bleeding battle scars in all of our heads. We're on a sort of bridge with the Rhode Island School of Design here, engaging the art director of a breakthrough movie in animation. David Polonsky is a visiting fellow at RISD and at Brown. His Oscar-nominated film, Waltz with Bashir, tracks one ex-soldier's hound dog nightmares to their 25-year-old roots in Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982. That was the war that culminated in the infamous massacres in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps. The movie is told in living comic book style. It's the story of one man's pursuit of what his memory won't let him recall. David Polonsky, I woke up at 3 in the morning after seeing Waltz with Bashir and felt my heart pounding in time with those nightmare dogs chasing me down. And I thought for sure this movie is playing with something in my head. Hmm. What is it? How'd you do it?
I guess, as you said, it's a story of this one man. And it started out as his own quest for artistic expression, I think. In talking about Ari Folman, the director and the producer and screenwriter of the film. So I guess, it started out as something highly personal, looking for a way to look basically into his own memory, and this is how he came to the choice to use animation and drawing, which is probably one of the best ways to depict memory or dreams and hallucinations, and these are the elements that this film is made of.
Can I say that's one of the most interesting puzzles about the movie? You animate by a slow process of computer-assisted assembly. Do you try to hypothesize here some analogy with the way memory sorts out the sounds and the frames of old images?
Definitely. And I'm going to use an analogy that I've used a number of times, and that would be to making a calculation. If you want to figure out to multiply numbers, you sometimes would want to write them down. And you might ask, why do you need to do that? Because the technology is in your head. But you make a mark in the world and then look at it, turning yourself into a third person. And I think the same might be said about drawing, which is, again, a mean of making yourself into a third person and basically looking at your thoughts, memories, things that do not exist in any physical form. And doing that in depicting an historical event is somewhat a way to eliminate the middleman, meaning photography or any other kind of representation which would involve reenactment.
So the animator does something fundamentally different from the photographer.
Absolutely different.
Take it apart.
One way for Ari to make a film about the war in 82 would be to go in the what might be called the usual way, interviews and the use of archival footage. But there are a couple of problems with that. One would be the fact that there are no footages of the exact and the specific individual stories being told in the film. The other reason would be we got jaded about those images. We kind of were used to them, and they are no longer very effective.
Hmm. Is there something wrong with them or something wrong with us?
I think it's basically it's us, I think, because flipping through channels on TV, by now we know in a fragment of a second what the thing is about. We don't need to listen to
them. We pretend we know.
We pretend yes. And this is the reaction of the audience would be mostly automatic to something that is presented. And this is there's something interesting about the choice to use live footage in the end of the film. And I think if we would have shown the film ends with footage from of just corpses from the result of the massacre.
Yeah, this is it sort of cuts to color film. It's like The Secret Garden, those old movies, Wizard of Oz, that end on color. Mm-hmm. Color film, and it's Palestinian women screaming their remorse over these piles of cadavers. Yeah. Were you trumping the animation or what? Just making the old references.
There's a number of reasons for that, but what I was aiming at this point is the fact that if we were to show these images in the beginning or just forget about the film and just show images of a massacre, some people would look away, some people would not look away, but basically they are familiar images. We've been seeing these images for at least 50 years. And I don't think that they would have had the same effect if they were not preceded by 90 minutes of animation. Not to say that the 90 minutes of animation were made to help these images come across. That was not the reason, but this is kind of a way to explain the animation.
The premise then is that the animator connects somehow more intimately, maybe even more ethically, with the truth of warfare. But how did you do it?
I'm not sure if it's more truthful. I think the key word here is storytelling. The fact that we're dealing with intimate stories, individual stories, with dreams and hallucinations might be the key to a better communication of the message or the feeling or whatever it might be. The fact that we made a point out of not meeting the people who were telling the stories, not doing too much historical resource, and just telling their stories. And the film is not a history lesson, it's not a political manifesto, it's a story. And I guess if it's successful, it's successful with its storytelling devices. And that might be a case of art, maybe, dealing with history, but it's a work of art, hopefully.
May I introduce Amy Kravitz, who teaches animation at RISD and has been making animated films since she was 11 years old. Amy, how would you teach this movie? How do you teach it?
Well, I think one of the major discussions we've had in David's residency has been about creating authenticity in the characters. And I think that from an animation standpoint, this is one of the fascinating things about this movie in particular, is that the characters are more real than real people. And I think a lot of design work was done to make that happen, which David should probably explain about that process. But I think that's from an art directing standpoint, I think achieving that authenticity. And the other structural point I would focus on with students is the idea of the film having a central metaphor structurally. Even the whole title, we had a long discussion about the title yesterday. The title, Waltz with Bashir, is a metaphor. And I think that one of the great strengths of this film, which is a conundrum at its center, I mean, an animated documentary is a conundrum, but is the strength of metaphor as something that's also realer than real and something that we can process.
The waltz is also, to my mind, the most gripping scene in the whole movie. The soldier on his way to death, but going slightly crazy in front of the posters of Bashir Jamal, and he's firing his submachine gun in a kind of waltz time and spinning around like a dancer.
Mm-hmm. It's actually, interestingly, one of the only times you see the soldier in relationship to an image of Bashir, the other. You know, we're with Israelis the entire time, and all the Lebanese people in it are actually you're graphically separated from them, except at that one moment when you have the frontal shot of Bashir.
You make the point, though, that animation gets deeper and closer to character than video would. I mean, this sounds like radio. We think that radio gets deeper for taking the imagery out entirely. How specifically does the animator do it?
I think the animator works inside the psychology of the viewer, using sort of basic, simple, communicative shapes.
That's what they say about radio, too.
Well,
that the listener conjures a better picture than Hollywood can give us.
I think because you have to engage the imaginative process of the viewer. You want them, they're your partner in creating. So you have to leave enough space for them to participate with you.
Do you agree?
Absolutely, yes. And I think that there's something about that moment in the film with the image of Bashir. It's the point where we are departing from the individual stories.
Tell me how you did it, how you created that very clear sort of climax. In my experience of the movie, at that moment, the waltz.
First of all, the structure of the film leads to that. It's kind of, we've heard enough individual stories up to that point, and now we kind of have to take a stand about it, and we kind of need to start to depart from the individual towards the historical or whatever that is. It's very hard for me to analyze it because it's a lot of technical decisions that lead to something that is bigger. One of the reasons we ended up with this huge poster of Bashir is because we couldn't do technically something else we were meaning to do. And it came about, like many things in this kind of work, out of limitations, or out of technical limitations, budget limitations, pushing us to come up with more creative solutions. So we needed to give a face to the historic event, and the simple solution was to give it a face, and the face is of Bashir Jumail.
Mm. James Derderian of the Watson Institute at Brown is the author of Virtuous War, a book just out in paperback. James, you're conditioning us to think of the military-industrial media entertainment complex and to wake up to all the imagery and information technology that are built into war plans now and war consumption. What did you see in this movie?
Well, I saw an incredibly brave effort to tell the war story. I mean, the war story is probably one of the toughest stories to recount because, first of all, it's etched in trauma, and the reaction to trauma is usually sort of some silence. It could be an official silence, as we saw from the Israeli government, or a repression, the personal silencing that goes on within our own subconscious. And the film brilliantly conveyed that. traditionally, I think, as well, you sort of broke this sort of Hobson choice. Do you give sort of a documentary neutral account of war, or do you give that sort of blood-soaked, on-the-beach cinema verite, the sort of, you know, Saving Private Ryan, which is really about trying to save the reality principle of war. It's about death, obviously. But I think you broke through that binary by using animation. You didn't go for the sort of neutral, you didn't go for the expose. And the third aspect of it that was really, I think, quite remarkable and innovative is how you walk that line between the sort of the realistic depiction that leads to kind of a war porn. You know, people get titillated by war. You've dealt with that. I mean, you actually brought in real porn, I think, to deal with, you know, all the repressions of war and how it gets mixed in with all the things we don't like to see and think about in a sort of a public forum.
That was interesting. Can I just say there's an officer watching porn films in his apartment in Beirut as all of this mayhem proceeds around him.
Yeah, I think it's what you've done is sort of bring something out, the return of the repressed, obviously. Mm-hmm. But you've tapped into a collective unconscious. I don't want to get too psychoanalytical here, but obviously, you know, your primary character is going through a self-analysis with the help of an analyst as well. And it's amazing how, by tapping into that collective unconscious, it's not just simply a personal war story. It becomes, I think, a war story about any person, any nation state, any people that's been traumatized by violence. And that came out as well, I think, very effectively through this innovative use of animation. Then making the leap into the verisimilitude of the dead body, which ultimately is the fundamental reality of war.
James, you're always teaching us about this screen culture we live in, saturated with imagery, but in the matter of war, imagery that typically overpowers any reflection or empathy or maybe any real engagement with the panic of war, the devastation of war. What did animation, the animation piece, do for you?
Well, I have to say I was equally disturbed, as you said, Chris, because at one hand, the defamiliarization lets you initially take a distance from the story. But at some point, and I think it has to do with the way the brain visually assimilates information, the filter or the rational distancing fell by the wayside. I felt like it was almost directly accessing a part of the brain, because after all, a brain through evolution is adapted to register visual images first and in a primal way. Then it goes up to our language center, which is a much smaller part of our brain. Mm-hmm. So it was almost you got into some sort of primal neurological, I'm going to call it the sort of, you know, the truth center. And I found the film much more disturbing and harder to understand in a kind of removed intellectual way than if it had been a straight frame that I'm more familiar with, which is documentary film or Hollywood war blockbuster. So I think that's why it all came back into our nightmares. I mean, we all know, you know, what Marx said about the unconsciousness of the past. It weighs on us like a nightmare. That somehow triggered all kinds of past memories about war in my own family history. So I think it was just remarkable how you're able to achieve that sort of almost a new channeling of a part of the brain normally isn't part of film watching, film spectating.
Keith Brown of the Watson Institute, you're an anthropologist. You taught this business of war stories at Brown with Deborah Scranton, who made that movie War Tapes about New Hampshire National Guardsmen in Iraq. What did you observe? What did your anthropological eye see in Waltz with Bashir?
Well, it was a great film, and for me, the power of the film is in the storytelling, as you've described it. So I'm not sure I agree with James about the primal imagery short-circuiting the voices, because without the voices, it doesn't work. But I'm actually curious about the specific Israeli context for this, because the IDF has a certain reputation for efficiency outside, at least, you know, right? It's there's a certain kind of myth of the Israeli military forces as great at what they do, and the story kind of fragments that a little bit. The other thing about it for me is that has the film sort of gone into a space where these discussions of complicity, involvement, what exactly was going on in Lebanon in 1982, is that a discussion that was already going on, or is this film open spaces for that discussion? Mm-hmm.
There's a number of points in what you said that I'd like to address. First of all, just to get it out of the way, the image of the IDF that you mentioned is something that it was trying to uphold for a very long time, but I don't think that it was ever true. Its efficiency or whatever. Yeah. And if there's hope for Israel, it's in the fact that it's a huge mess. And people were not talking about Sabra and Shatila. It's a very sore spot, and it's so important that people don't talk about it. There was a public discussion very shortly after the events. There was a government committee, and then it was repressed completely. And just saying the word Sabra and Shatila eliminates any kind of discussion. It's just it's too big. I think because it's kind of a watershed mark from the point where I think that in that point many Israelis really felt that we're not better than anybody else. Not necessarily worse, but not better.
The verdict of the government inquiry, of course, was that the Christian phalangists did the killing in Sabra and Shatila to avenge Bashir Gemayel, but that the Israeli troops who had control of the situation enabled it and lit it, in effect. And were in some measure, including Ariel Sharon, responsible.
Yeah. Well, what were they doing there to begin with? That's a big question.
Can I ask you all a slightly more political question? But there's an insinuation in Walter Bashir of an infinite past behind the nightmares in this movie. A psychiatrist tells the soldier that he was carrying in his head the mental burden of the Nazi camps 40 years before the massacres in Beirut, and God knows how far behind the Nazi camps went the experiences and the trauma that produced them. There's also a suggestion in the movie that an endlessly violent future lies ahead, and the Gaza massacres after the movie was made last December could be taken to confirm it. Do we have to live with those very, very grim, dark notions of an infinite regress and an infinite future of massacre?
I certainly hope not, but it's in speaking about documentation in that context, the fact that it's hard to tell because the industrialized massacres came to be together with visual advances in documentation, visual documentation. I don't know what would happen to the Armenian Holocaust if it were filmed as the Holocaust. I don't know. So I really have no idea if the fact that we can see the images helps to prevent them, or maybe it helps to perpetrate I don't know, because...
Well, I think a movie viewer comes away from Walter Bashir just sort of praying for an intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Did you think of the movie itself as an intervention?
Yes, of course. Yeah, but nobody involved in the work in the film was thinking for a moment that this would stop wars in any place. It's expression. This is art. This is the need of the soul to express itself, and it's not made to achieve a certain outcome, but it's there to say I'm here and I can't stand it anymore.
James,
well, I took away one lesson, that is that dreams start wars, dreams can end wars.
Mm.
So it's dream interpretation that will help us facilitate perhaps that caesura. The punctum at the end of the dead body isn't sufficient to stop war. We've seen so many dead bodies. But again, it's the framing, the captioning, the use of new techniques to sort of wake us up, I mean, from the dream or nightmare in this case. So I think, if only momentarily, you know, this film, documentary, dreamscape, forces us to confront, you know, the permanence of war in many societies and how there is a mass as well as individual psychosis that is created by that permanence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we don't want to face it. So, in fact, this is probably the most therapeutic film, I think, is that's out there right now in that regard.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, I've said that...
War is a force that gives us nightmares, but that might wake us up.
Well, how you represent the war in a way that gets beyond the sort of, you know, the banalities of representation, or even like using the word like banality of evil, because that's banal in itself. How you get beyond sort of the traditional ways of, you know, just simply condemning war, because that doesn't work. Outlawing war doesn't work. It's really about people finally saying, you know, I won't go to war. It's going to change.
Yeah.
People saying the cost is too high, personally, politically, collectively.
Yeah. If one kid in Israel, I don't know about the rest of it, comes out of the film saying, well, it's not that cool to go into a combat unit, we did something, and I have no idea if it's happening, but that would be a very welcome outcome.
And I would just say, you know, for self-defense, obviously war is going to be a necessity, and it's going to be, you know, deciding, you know, what's the difference between self-defense and aggression, offensive war, and how you put limitations, because there is a tendency, we know from Clausewitz, for all war, if you don't have political constraints, to tend towards total war, towards genocide, towards massacre.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been lacking that kind of civilian constraint. I don't put the finger on the military in this case. I put the, if we're going to, you know, it's on the civilian leaders in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Keith Brown, what kind of an intervention were you looking for, and what kind of an intervention could this sort of film be?
Well, I'm going to momentarily channel Deborah Scranton again. One of the things that she felt strongly, which motivated her to make that film in the first place, was these stories aren't being told, and the more stories are told and heard, the more the young potential soldiers will hear, they'll get a fuller and fuller picture. That was often her take, and I'm actually not convinced by that, because you get to the point of saturation with stories in the same way as you get to the point of saturation with images that you described at the beginning. So people just look away or stop listening. Back to Chris's question, we come back to the color in vivo footage. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about the decision process of actually... I imagine it was quite contested within the team to take that route.
I was actually opposed to it throughout the work on the film. Mm. It kind of bothered me the fact that we would have to edit the images, which is, again, a very strong intervention. And it seemed to me just too long, kind of rubbing your face in the blood, just a bit too kind of gory, almost. But watching the film with audiences, I kind of grew to agree more and more with Ari about his decision, which was there from the beginning. Actually, at some point there was talk about putting that in earlier in the film, but it was thrown right away.
What was it you saw in the audience's reactions?
Well, the fact that they're staying throughout the credits, I think, and in many cases people would come out teary-eyed of the film. So I realized that we touched a nerve, obviously, and the footage in the end had absolutely, well, you feel it. I don't know. I can't analyze it too much, but I think that the thing is the use of sound, which is paramount to what happens, and the sound
screams.
Yeah, and they aren't. We made a point out of not using actual sound throughout the film. We didn't want to use, we tried to reenact voices as little as possible. There are a couple of places in the film where we brought in people shouting in the background because it just didn't work without it. But ideally, we would like to have only the voiceover narration, just because the image is fabricated and the sound is real. It's physical. It's not a representation. Mm. It enters your body, so it's through the ears. It's something else. So when the real sound is introduced in the end, it has a very strong impact, and that's an artistic device. Mm. It's not even a moral decision per se. It's just to add weight to the punch. The fact that we are not hearing a lot of women throughout the film. There's only one woman, and that's the psychiatrist in the middle. And the moment you hear the women crying and you realize that it's real sound, it's absolutely clear that those are not actors crying, you're immediately taken away from the, hopefully, from the representation into the physical experience, because the sound is present in the theater.
James.
There's a tradition on the show that I always bring in at least one quote from Walter Benjamin whenever Chris has me on it. And it just so happens there's one that I think really relates to what you have achieved in the documentary. And it's from the Arcades Project, and Walter Benjamin, who suffered, of course, through the trauma of Nazism and Holocaust and committed suicide while trying to escape from that experience. And he wrote, "The imminent awakening is poised like the wooden horse of the Greeks in the Troy of dreams." I think that's kind of what you just achieved through this film. We'll see what happens. We'll see what comes out of that horse.
No, could I ask one final non-Walter Benjamin question at the end? How did you and Ari Vollman feel at the time of Gaza, December 08, not just the massacre, but the fact that the war seemed to be hugely popular in Israel?
Yeah. Deeply depressed, It's very unnerving, and it's very hard to remain optimistic. It's the sense was that we lost the last strongholds of rationality, and everybody's well insane. And it's I don't see any. Again, I'm kind of, if there is some kind of hope, it's in chaos. It's in the fact that this is not a result of any kind of rational thinking. And when it's not rational, it can change in a moment. Because if it doesn't change in a moment, it would take, the end wouldn't come in my lifetime. And I'm not prepared to that.
A strong thought at the end. Thank you enormously. David Polonsky, thank you, James Dudarian, thank you, Keith Brown, thank you, Amy Kravitz.
Great, thanks.
Sarah Archambault and Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Listeners, feedback at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.